for lead tests. That's in due in part to, you know, the publicity about the problem with respect to schools and the publicity with respect to air quality issues that we've had in the city. I would forecast that that's not a permanent condition, that we will not be permanently ramped up to this new level. So it would seem to me these might be limited term positions rather than permanent FTEs, because I don't expect that we're going to have that volume of requests forever. But what do you think?
Yeah, if I could just throw in there, why can't we contract with a water quality lab to do the test?
Cecilia Hoon with the Water Bureau. Mayor, your question about whether the spike in the sampling is temporary. We are committed to doing testing for daycare, for the hospitals, for the schools. And we are projecting that it's going to take us a couple of years to get through this cycle. And then some of that permanent position is to help coordinate some of that work. In addition to taking in the sampling, we anticipate that even after that, the spike isn't going to come back down to the same level. It might come down to some degree. And then with the addition of increased regulatory requirements, we're seeing also increases in, you know, just lab analysis, having to do more testing of the water. And so in addition to the three positions that we're asking, we're also asking for three temporary positions, understanding that, you know, the spike is really significant right now, as Commissioner Fish mentioned, and that we're sort of augmenting with permanent staff and using temporary staff to get through the next couple of years. And then looking out beyond that, we also expect more regulatory requirements coming down. They are looking at the lead and copper rule. They're also looking at the total coliform rule. There's a lot of regulatory requirements that
the mayor makes a good point. We are projecting a new normal, but that's why we wouldn't see this as just a one-year deal. But we are not looking just to add capacity for the sake of capacity. And so we would certainly report back to council annually. And I think the new normal is going to be higher. And by the way, we like the fact that more people are testing, because it means they're reading our inserts about testing, which is free, about flushing their water, about getting putting a filter on their water, and doing all kinds of common sense things, which can greatly reduce the risk of lead exposure in water.
Just to clarify, Commissioner, you are just asking for position authority. You're not asking for general fund?
That's correct.
Thank you.
That's correct. And we are proposing in the regular budget to, when we come back, to cover the cost without a rate increase.
And why not contract with a water quality lab to do the work?
We looked at the cost of contracting the work out to outside labs. We found that it's more expensive than hiring the permanent staffing. We also looked at using BES's lab, and their cost, you know, they also have a capacity limitation to help us as well. But their cost, you know, it costs actually the Bureau less to have the staff in-house as opposed to using even the BES lab staff.
Show you the analysis, because that's a great point. And the other benefit, of course, is we have at Interstate our lab and all of our people in one, and lots of sophisticated equipment. So we're using the same labs and equipment, just augmenting our staff. We do have people working long shifts, long hours because of the spike. And again, council was briefed on how dramatically the spike has been in terms of requested tests. So, Mayor, my hope is I can persuade you and my colleagues to include it in your request. And if not, we don't have enough time, I am prepared to bring a friendly amendment and hope to get your consent.
Okay, thank you.
So from a process standpoint, we did have to file for next week, so it would need to be amended, we're happy to help craft that.
Emphasis on the friendly amendment.
Right. You know, one quick question. The state has commented that they might be reimbursing school districts for the cost of testing for lead. Since we are doing that on behalf of the school districts, if that funding comes through, will we be in line to collect some of that?
Gabe Salmer, Deputy Director. We certainly would love to be in line. I don't expect that. We are working with the Office of Government Relations. We're working directly with our partners in the schools and in the legislature. But I understand that that would be a very small piece of what we've already done. And we're not doing testing for Portland Public Schools on an ongoing basis. So it would be a small portion of that piece.
Can I ask a question? Because I'm on a school board. You say it's free, the testing for schools?
that's free for all of our customers. So we serve a million people in the region.
Well,
including,
you serve us. You serve
including school districts and homeowners and business people. And the testing is free, and it's part of our regulatory requirement through the lead and copper rule.
Okay, I'm just curious because I just heard about how much we're spending paying for lead testing, and so I...
Well, lead mitigation is a different matter.
Huh?
So the actual work on the
plumbing
is
I'm talking
a different matter.
Testing.
Yeah,
testing,
and what one of the things
I'll get
is
clarification.
It's not only part of our regulatory requirement, but it's a low barrier program to encourage people to take advantage of it.
No, I understand, but often some of these programs aren't known to others, including school districts, and so I wanted to double check since I have a school board meeting.
And so, just on that point. In the early spring, we held a meeting with the heads of all the school districts that we serve in the Multnomah County area, and we reviewed what services we provide and what issues we responded to issues of concern they had, and we have a very strong partnership with those school districts, and that includes providing technical assistance, making sure that they get concierge service and prompt responses, and we've been coordinating with all the school districts in Multnomah County.
I look at it both sides because that may be free. I want to find out for my school district what I'm paying for in my budget because of the comment.
So if I may, I just have three quick things to note that are also that are part of the fall supplemental budget. You have Exhibit 5 in your packet, and it just notes the position changes included in the budget. There are almost 82 positions being added in this bump. That is a significant number. Again, we've reviewed those, and CBO has recommended those going through with a few tweaks here or there. But the bulk of those positions are in Bureau of Development Services because of the dramatically increased workload there. Although I think it is worth noting that Bureau of Development Services is now at a higher staffing level than they were before the downturn and the recession. So again, it's something to continue to have that conversation with them during the budget process around what the long-term staffing plan is, you know, particularly if things even out. There's 22 positions in the Bureau of Transportation, mostly to deal with the capital projects that are coming their way. And then 15 positions in the Office of Management and Finance. A fair number of those are facilities related, again, as they're moving forward on some of those projects, and then positions scattered through other bureaus as well. So I wanted to note that. In Exhibit 2 of your packet on page 6, there are two things I want to just make sure that we highlight. There is a current appropriation level change that is being proposed as part of this fall supplemental to the Housing Bureau's budget for the $3.5 million that was unfunded in their IGA with Multnomah County. This is sort of a technical issue. Council's already approved the IGA. To increase, you know, that amount to $15 million. The only question here is whether we increase the CAL target of the Housing Bureau, which means that $3.5 million gets spread throughout the general fund as part of the forecast, and we deal with it on a citywide basis, which I believe was Council's intent when they passed the IGA. The alternative would be not to give Housing Bureau the CAL target increase, which means that the Housing Bureau would have to request that whole $3.5 million, and if Council next year did not fund it, those cuts would have to come out of the Housing Bureau. We recommend the CAL target change because I believe that was the intent of Council, and this is the way to do that. Again, the IGA has been signed. This is just an issue of how it gets addressed next year. And then the final change, it's technical, but it does have a material impact on the general fund. One of the things that the City Budget Office does every few years is we review the overhead model to make sure that the costs included in the model are appropriate. In reviewing that and in seeing sort of the increased costs with IPR, we do think that IPR should be pulled from the overhead model. It does provide a citywide function, but not a citywide function that benefits all city bureaus. So just pulling that out of the model has about $1 million impact on the general fund, doesn't impact the funding for IPR at all. It just means that we've trued that up in the forecast, and so this is council authorization to do that moving forward. We think it's the appropriate thing to do from a technical standpoint.
Thank you. So questions, comments from our budget advisors? Or
did we have some turn?
Yeah, no, them, you too.
Actually, Mayor, it's my understanding there's a late-breaking add-on request for funding that has something to do with derelict mobile homes that Robert King and Dave Benson were here to talk about. So I was hoping we could get to that.
Thank you. On the Parks FEMA money, We only got, we're guessing $1.2 million for the sale of the Tabor site, so we're still going to be short $478,000 to get that FEMA match. And secondly, when we arranged the sale of that to the Housing Bureau, my plan was to either use it to buy new parks in places that don't have them or to address some more of the maintenance, which is what we've been directed to do, is to try to avoid getting into more and more backlog of maintenance. So I'm really concerned that we've been told to, and in this proposal, we're directed to put that into something that doesn't have long-term benefit, really, and which we would otherwise get from the general fund.
How would we obtain the other 478, and when does that come due?
Well, I think the from the city budget office perspective, this would be the first priority in terms of parks existing maintenance money because of the match. Because of that, it leverages essentially three times the investment that we would put in with the federal government paying it back. So it you know, because of the damage that was done, it does need to be repaired. That this rises to the top of the list again because of that match. So $1.2 million funded through the land transfer, and then the other $400,000 out of existing maintenance. Absolutely, that means existing maintenance projects get delayed a little bit further. That is the trade-off.
A lot of the major maintenance money is spent on emergency repairs throughout our system, so it's not probably just sitting there waiting to be spent.
No, that's right. It would need to be. There would definitely be a cost. It just seemed like the 3-to-1 match from the federal government raised the level of those mostly culvert repairs higher on the list. If you have anything.
Yeah, Ryan Kinsel at the Budget Office. I was just going to also add, too, that the parks can fire an 18-month extension to ask for reimbursement for FEMA for some of the projects. So if they're not funded within the current $1.2 million resources, that would be from the Tabor Annex property. If there's any potential for using some of that, any underspending on the other projects, they could come back over an 18-month window to ask for the additional funds.
But we changed the policy. We don't have to sell $400,000 of park land. We did away with that.
Sorry, I think that's a slightly different issue. I'm just saying that if they need the additional $400,000 to request the full FEMA reimbursement, for the full FEMA reimbursement, they can do that over an 18-month window. They don't have to be asking for the full amount immediately. That can happen over...
You're just saying there's time
there's
to
additional
identify
time.
That $400,000.
That's correct. Yep.
It's just kicking the can down the road, though, isn't it?
Proposal and what it would cost and what it would do.
Mayor and Commissioners, thank you very much. Robert King, East Precinct, Portland Police Bureau. We obviously have been engaged in an effort now for some time to be responsive to community concerns about homelessness. The cleanup on the spring water obviously has recently been in focus, both in the precinct and for City Hall and for the community. We've worked very closely and are very grateful for our partnership that we have with PBOT and all the work that David Benson has done. One of the subset areas of concerns for neighbors and one of the complaints we regularly receive is the presence of RVs in and throughout our neighborhoods and the impact that they're having on livability. There's a public safety impact from the standpoint of crimes that are being committed in and around them, but there's also a generalized health hazard because of the black water and the gray water that's associated with them. And we also have, because of the homelessness in Portland, just like other cities throughout the country generally, an extraordinary number of RVs that have taken up residence throughout the city. Now, PBOT has done an exceptional job when it's appropriate, according to city code, of tagging and towing those vehicles. And one of the things we've done, or PBOT and the police, working together with parks, has done is filled up a number of the tow lots. The tow lots are now disposing of these derelict RVs by giving them out to the community for no cost or a very low cost. And so we were looking essentially for a solution. We have what we think is a creative one, an innovative one that's designed to have an approach, three different legs to the stool. One of the approaches is to have a funding source upwards of $150,000 that would allow us to do some limited repairs on vehicles in cases where people actually do need some support and help in moving out of the city. And there are people that are in that category. In addition to that, we think that many of them, because of their condition, because they're not legal, they're not licensed, the ownership is unclear, or because they present a public safety hazard or a health hazard, that once they're in the possession of the tow lots, that they can be claimed by a process by the city, and those vehicles can, when it's appropriate, they can be cleaned, and that they can then be subsequently crushed. And the cleaning and the crushing is not inexpensive. It's about $700 or $800 a vehicle. So that's sort of the broad strokes of what we've come here to mention to you today. Sort of a thought we have about a certain subset or category of vehicles that are illegal, that are in and around schools, that represent, from the neighbor's point of view, a threat to the safety of kids that are in the area, and have created a public safety and health hazard in our community. And with the assistance of PBOT, this is one sort of creative solution that we're pursuing and are asking for your support for. David?
No, I can't add much to it. I'm Dave Benson. I work for the Bureau of Transportation. I really can't add much to what Robert just said, but we know there's 341 vehicles on the street today with people living in them. A fair share of them are recreational vehicles. When they are abandoned, we tow them to an abandoned auto lot. A lot of these things have broken gray and black water systems. They're a hazard because when they're lived in, the raw sewage goes right onto the street. And when they wind up in the tow yard, a lot of times the tow yard just recycles them back out because of the expense to actually recycle them and demolish them. So that's what this is about, to provide a mechanism so we can take these vehicles out of the circulation, as it were.
How much is the request?
$150,000.
Okay. I have a question. So these RVs are not occupied by anyone? Is that what you're saying?
Sometimes they are. They are in violation of the abandoned auto ordinance in neighborhoods. Yes, there are times when they're occupied.
So if we are take those RVs from these individuals, where are they going to go? And who is going to be the responsibilities to pay and then fund the housing of these families or individuals?
I think that's one of the challenges, the broader homelessness challenge for the city in terms of, finding suitable long-term housing for people. And yes, that is one side of the issue. I went to a neighborhood association meeting the other night where, in particular, they were concerned about a row of about 10 or 12 of the RVs. There was a considerable crime, prostitution, drug activity, and all of the things associated with that. They were inconsolable at the meeting and frustrated and discouraged that the city's inability really to address and deal with their livability concerns. So in terms of the complexity of the homelessness issue, yes, that is in some of these cases a factor. There are people that are in them and they have to find alternative places to go, but they're not legally in them. They're not legally on the street. And they are creating a health and safety hazard, a public safety health hazard that we're having to respond to and deal with in neighborhoods that is a very real concern to families and kids that are living and working in and around them. RVs throughout our city, the way that people are living in them, around them, not all people, this is not true for all people, but there are some cases where people should not have an RV out in front of their home with someone who regularly is using drugs in public, committing crimes of theft, urinating and defecating publicly, and engaged in other either health hazards or public safety hazards. That's the lion's share of what we, especially at East Precinct, have had to deal with and had to work with neighbors to figure out. And this is one solution, one part of the solution. That's why the suggestion is, if a part of this budget can go to identifying those people who are in need of help and support and assistance, and we can make some repairs and we can help them. And sometimes, because many times this is the case, they want to move from one place to another, but they're unable to. So this program is designed to take advantage of an opportunity to help an individual or a family in that situation, but then deal appropriately with those that are in violation of the city code or the law.
So when a vehicle is going to be towed in, crushed, I assume that there is a warning system ahead of time?
Yeah, there is a process. When a vehicle is abandoned, and oftentimes there's nobody living in when we tag them as abandoned. We go out between, it's 72 hours, typically it's more like a week. And if they're, the vehicle hasn't moved from where it was and it's still abandoned, it's towed by our contract tower to their tow yard. And it's held until an owner comes to release it. Oftentimes, what Robert was talking about, these vehicles have little or no value. I mean, I'd be happy to show some pictures to you, but they're really derelict vehicles that have no value.
We thought we have to distinguish between, there are some people who are living in an RV, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but they're not doing criminal behavior. We've got the regulation that's still, that says that faith groups can invite people in campers to be in their parking lot. I would imagine, well, I know, over this winter, there are places in RV parks where people could, if we could get the vehicle to them, like on Survey Island, for example, where you can hook them up to the sewer system, and maybe that will give somebody shelter over the winter. So I don't think it should always be tow it away and crush it.
But those aren't the vehicles that are being subject to tow. They're not on the city streets. So,
but they are.
Well, no, not if they're in a church parking lot or an
RV park. What I'm saying, but have we tried with outreach to tell people if you can get a faith community to let you in the parking lot that you could legally be there? Or is there a way that we could provide the subsidy to let them be on in an RV park with the appropriate hookups?
We're at a point where working with Mark Jolin and social service providers and advocates and anybody, frankly, in the community who is in support of an effort along those lines, we'd want to pursue every available option to us to help and support people and families that are in crisis or in need. And that for us, is always a priority. The lion's share of this kind of work has been done and will be done by the neighborhood response team, who has more experience and understanding and dealing effectively, I believe, with homelessness throughout the city than any other police resource or entity. So, yeah, we'd very much, as a part of this discussion, want to pursue, Commissioner, your suggestion about finding alternatives, especially for people who we think could benefit from that kind of support.
So, Robert, didn't you say that part of the use of the money would be to make repairs to vehicles so people could then take them somewhere else?
That's right.
So let me make a suggestion, because this is an innovative idea. I want to suggest that some combination of the two of you and Mark Jolin do a quick write-up for the council of how this would work. When I first heard about this problem, it was described in particular with respect to, and Dave mentioned this in passing, of vehicles that have been tagged, towed, taken to a storage lot by one of our contractors, left there for some time, and then in effect rolled out the back gate to anybody that wants it. Those aren't housing anybody at that moment. And I think we've been in a situation of towing some of these vehicles multiple times, right?
That's correct.
So interdicting that cycle seems to me to make a lot of sense. Dealing with the humane issues of the ones that are occupied and where somebody's getting displaced by the tow, to me, that's a pretty different situation. Obviously, we got to deal with those. And then if some of these vehicles are serviceable and somebody could be living them in a church parking lot, I don't want to see that one crushed either. But I think there's a community of agreement about those kind of objectives. But the particular problem of a derelict RV that gets towed into a lot and rolled out the back door for a dollar without benefit of title, that we need to stop. So how focused or how broad this effort is, I think, is open to council discussion and tuning, but it would probably be helpful for next week's discussion if the three of you and any others that could contribute to that could just give us a quick write-up about this so that we can ponder this a little more, and by the time we get to decision-making about amendments, we'll know not just and frankly, that dollar amount sounds to me, and that's okay, like a best guesstimate at what the first level of effort in this work might look like for 6 months. Fine, I get that. We don't really know over time how much this will cost, but it's worth a good look, and it might be worth spending that money and trying this once we know what this really is. Would that help? Okay. So if you all could cooperate on that in the next couple of days, that would be great for us. And by the time we get back together, we'll be able to consider that. Thank you very much.
After 2.5 hours, I have nothing further.
Anything else from our advisors that you want us to think about at this point? So again, next week we'll take this forward.
Yes, the supplemental budget will be heard on Wednesday.
Wednesday.
So, Ian, we're happy to help with any amendments.
Meantime, thank you very much. Great
thank
work.
You.
Great
Thanks
work all around. Thank you.
I do.
10.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see. I got it. Yeah, I wish it was easy just to fix it. It's my calf, not my Achilles.
When I heard about it, people were actually like, you thought it was your Achilles.
That would have been awful. No, it was my calf. It popped. It was like 30 seconds into the game. Well, I don't know. It's right like here. Pretty solid calf, right? And your Achilles is here, right?
When you go, I mean, the Achilles connects with your calf. Like, okay,
yeah.
It can be a high.
Well, we compressed. No, it was fine. It was fine.
So this is the test you have to do. When you go home, you have to lay on your stomach, put your leg up, and have stretches.
Why would I do that? Like, just so I could scream in pain?
Because you can do the test that if you're on a normal calf and you're a normal Achilles and you squeeze your calf, your foot flexes.